This is a recording of a sermon given at the First Unitarian Church of St. Louis.
Ooh, thank you for creating such a beautiful space for the goddess to enter. From the story to the music, beautiful, to the fabulous readings. Oh, you've made, and to the silence. You've made a space for her to enter. For in the beginning, the very beginning, our imagining of God was, of course, as a woman. It was a time when the greatest mystery of human existence began with the slow swelling of a woman's belly that in some mysterious way led to the creation of another life in the image of man or woman. Naturally, the God that put this miracle into motion had to be a woman. Men and women prayed to this God, praised her, and thanked her for the miracle of new life. They also marveled at the way a woman's breast would fill with milk to nourish this new life, and in the same image they prayed to a God in the image of woman to fill the heavens with rain to feed the hungry earth. Our lives were tied to nature then, to the cycles of birthing, and were filled with awe for Mother Earth and sky. But then came Yahweh. At first he was the consort, kind of a helper. You know, had the tools, I guess, I don't know. He was the partner to the goddess. And together they reflected that creation story in Genesis 1. Male and female, God created them in God's image. Male and female together, ordering the mysteries and breathing the life force into every generation. The Jewish mystics claim that there was great chaos in the beginning, and then everything fell out of balance, especially male and female. As we see in chapter 2 of Genesis, where some blame Eve for evil and suffering and the fall. Clearly, chapter 2 had a different agenda than chapter 1, where everything was equal. Our work, the mystics said, was tikkun olam, you see. The repair of the world, to those mystics, was to put the balance back in order with male and female attributes and values in balance once again. We have hints for this in our very language. Chochmah, the word for wisdom, and maybe even Torah, some suggest, comes from the word, from the name of the goddess Ashtoreth. Maybe. It's not such a stretch, you know. And the Shekhinah, of course, the indwelling, from the Hebrew word shochen, which means the indwelling. The word Shekhinah became the feminine name for the goddess, really. And it meant the inner God, the inner experience of God, the God that was named by that beautiful poem that you both read. The indwelling of God and all of these feminine attributes were woven into the Jewish mystical tradition, though, you know, the rabbis always tried to say, no, that's not what we mean. But even the book of Esther, who's Esther but Astarte, right? And Mordechai, the other hero in the book of Esther, Marduk. You know, they came from Persia, so doesn't it make sense? Because Esther is not a Hebrew name. Her Hebrew name was Hadassah. Esther is a four-letter root. It could not have been Hebrew. So it makes more sense that it's really a story using the goddess and her consort, Astarte and Marduk. In fact, in the 16th century, now I will admit this is my theory, and I haven't yet had too many people agree with me, but stay with me because it makes so much sense, doesn't it? Have you heard of the 16th century? He was kind of called a pseudo-messiah, Sabbatai Zvi. Yes? So Sabbatai Zvi in the 16th century believed so strongly that the only way to bring this repair was to bring women back into the religious realm, to bring women consciousness, both male and female, in the religious realm, to him the most important realm. He believed it so strongly that he insisted on teaching women to read from the Torah in the Ottoman Empire. Now, my grandfather was a Turk. It had to be a revolution. He was a revolutionary. He wanted to bring women's voices back. He was teaching women to read Torah in the 16th century. Can you believe that? In Turkey. Hello. Because he wanted them to be equal in the most important realm, the religious realm, because he believed that once men and women were equal once again, the messianic era would dawn and we would have peace. We would figure out a way to live together because we'd have everything we needed, you see. No surprise. So what happened to Sabbatai Zvi? Right? The rabbis turned him in, said, oh, he's a threat to the political structure. They had to find a way to silence him. So they turned him in to the Ottoman authorities, and he was forced to convert to Islam. But today, if you Google this, you'll see there's still a group called Sabbateans out there in the world somewhere. And they do have some kind of equality going on there for women. So, you know, I love being here, and I really want to thank Reverend Perchlik for this wonderful invitation. And as he mentioned, this particular opportunity came from a conversation that we had across the street with your wonderful intern, Cecilia Owen. I was quoting one of my favorite passages, I'll do it any chance you give me, to quote from Jeremiah 44 on this topic of bringing back awareness of what happened to the goddess. We were in some kind of class. Was it a class or something? And Cecilia said, oh, here's another connection with First U across the street. We're doing our Baking Cakes for the Queen of Heaven curriculum. I said, you know, I was told once that I was credited in that first version that was created by Shirley Rank, but I never really saw that I was. I guess you did some research and found out that I really was. And I remember the day, there was a Unitarian conference in Cincinnati when I was a student. I was asked to come give a talk on the goddess. And I talked about Jeremiah 44, baking cakes for the Queen of Heaven. And that was the kernel, I think, for the curriculum. At least that's what I've been told. So over 30 years ago, the talk that I gave was called When God Was a Woman. And in it, I made the case that it was essential to understand that teaching of Jeremiah when he admonishes the people for worshiping both God and the goddess. God goes to Jeremiah and says, Jeremiah, you're not doing your job. You're not being a good prophet of Yahweh. Those people are baking cakes for the Queen of Heaven. Tell them to stop. So Jeremiah goes, oy, you know. But Jeremiah's a good, you know, prophet, so he goes. He does. He goes to the people and he says, hey, God's mad. Stop baking cakes to the Queen of Heaven. And the people answer him, my favorite words, my favorite words in Torah. We have no intention of listening to the words you have spoken in Yahweh's name, Jeremiah. We intend to go on doing all that we have vowed to do, offering incense to the Queen of Heaven and pouring libations in her honor as we used to do. We and our ancestors, our kings and our leaders in the towns of Judah and the streets of Jerusalem. Why? Because when we did that, we had plenty of food and rain, and we lived well, and we suffered no disasters. But since we have given up offering incense to the Queen of Heaven and pouring libations in her honor, we have become destitute, and we have perished either by the sword or famine. Pretty clear message, don't you think? And don't you think it's interesting that it didn't get edited out of the Bible? I can say that here, right? You know, it was such a strong voice. It was such a strong tradition. Even those, you know, JEP guys couldn't edit it out. The story was there. Pretty clear that they were talking about what happens when the society is out of balance. But the prophets of Yahweh won. And as obvious references to the female attributes of God disappeared, women's status in society became secondary, as is reflected in the second creation story of Genesis, where, you know, she comes out of his side and she's subservient. You know, we love the story of Lilith, that first crazy woman, right, with the flowing red hair, who left the garden because she said, I can't deal with this guy. He doesn't want me to be equal. So she leaves, and of course we make her into a demon, but We know that eventually Eve and Lilith make peace, they become sisters, and they try to teach Adam how to walk in the world, you know, with both. So how wonderful to find yet another connection between our two communities. But how sad that we are still trying to restore wholeness to our imaginings of God and to restore the world's women to our place, holding up, as has been said, half of the sky. 40 years later, we are still hearing about the Chinese proverb that teaches us that women hold up half the sky, and the understanding that keeping us from doing this is one of the basic problems with the world. Too many women are being kept from holding up their part of the sky. With poor education, not enough access to health care, and not making a living wage, no matter how many hours one works, all keep women throughout the world from holding up their part of the sky. But it is slowly changing. And you know, real change takes time, doesn't it, Ramona? You know, you can't expect immediate results. I remember the first time I went to that corner of Redbud there, and the first time we saw that site, it was still a place where dead bodies were left. There were still gunshots heard in the neighborhood. The next year, we didn't hear any gunshots after we marched. No dead bodies, and there was just a little bit of a garden, but there still weren't too many people out playing in the streets. But by the third year, this past year, oh my goodness, the garden is growing. There were children playing on the streets. No gunshots were heard. People were out and about and bringing each other food and celebrating. You weren't feeling too well that night, I know, but you were there anyway, and we lit candles. And someday we won't have candles to light for all the people, the young people who are dying of the gunshot wounds. But that neighborhood is changing. It takes time. It takes time. Change comes slowly. Let's think about little Malala in Pakistan who risked her life to go to school. The little Nigerian girls who risked their lives to go to school to take their exams. And right here, so many brave fast food workers who are risking their jobs for a living wage, one that would lift themselves and their children out of the poverty cycle to be a part of the community so that they too can hold up their part of the sky. This past week across the street, we studied the story of Korach in the book of Numbers. Now we learn about rebellions from Korach. You know, he was that rebel that questioned and challenged Moses' authority. He says, "Who do you think you are? Aren't all the people holy?" I mean, he said the right things, right? Are not all the people holy? Moses has told us that again and again. It's the right question, and it was the right critique that Korach made. It's why we left Egypt, to create a new paradigm for a society. Instead of rich and poor, haves and have-nots, masters and servants, we were going to create a society where the playing field was equal, where, as Moses says again and again, everyone was recognized as being holy, as having something to bring. Remember the story of Nadab and Avihu? Moses is told to, okay, go give the spirit of prophecy to 70 elders. And so he gathers them in the tent, and Moses gives them the spirit of prophecy, and these two guys, Nadab and Avihu, are on the side of the tent, and they get it, kind of just because they're standing there. And they go out, and they start prophesying. And Joshua goes, "Hey, who do those guys think they are? Moses, tell them to stop." And Moses says the best thing, you know, that really applies to anyone who's been left out or been marginalized. Moses said, "Would that everyone would be a prophet. Would that everyone would take on the responsibility of speaking holiness, you know, truth to power." This is the journey through the wilderness, you see, and this is the whole point of the Torah, to take us closer to the promised land where everyone can sit under their vine and fig and none will be afraid, no matter what neighborhood or what zip code they're sitting in, right? You know, when we learn to live together, we know that there will always be enough. Korach says the right words, but we know that what he wants is just more of the power. Nothing will change. So the earth swallows him and the other rebels up. But a few chapters later, we meet the Benot Zlofchad, the daughters of Zlofchad, and they give us a whole new model of rebellion. These five sisters are overlooked when Moses is giving out the portions of the land. The father of these five daughters had no sons, and he died before Moses was able to pass out the portions. Their father would have inherited a portion of land, and if he had a son, the son would have inherited without question. But Moses skips over the daughters because they are women. Not a good idea, Moses. Interesting how the daughters of Zlofchad then approach Moses in the text. Not with a rebellion and angry threats like Mokorach did a few chapters ago when he felt that he was being left out. No, these women approach Moses nonviolently and with a thoughtful strategy. And they pleaded not just for themselves, as Korach did, but they plead for future generations as well. We learn from the daughters of Zlofchad that it will take time, but when we liberate the feminine side of God, there is hope that everyone will have a voice, a vote, and everyone will be able to add to the tikkun, the repair of the world. You know, another connection that we have here is Olympia Brown, the Universalist minister who was the very first woman to be ordained as anything in America in 1863. And I know your Reverend Perchlik knows more about her than I do. But I want to say that I went to the university, St. Lawrence University, where she was ordained, and I saw her every day for 4 years. Because her face adorns the chapel that I would sneak away to hide in when I needed, you know, a moment to reflect on what I was doing with my life. There she was, Olympia Brown. She's a bust on the chapel right there. And Olympia Brown believed that freedom of religious thought and a liberal church would supply the groundwork for all other freedoms. And in working for justice, she was fierce and feisty and relentless, much like the daughters of Zlofchad. She had no time for the social niceties with which women were expected to concern themselves. Even in 1863, she said, "We are engaged in carrying forward the greatest reform that has ever been undertaken on behalf of freedom, and we have only made a beginning. There is much to be done." And what was she talking about? She was talking about the ordination of women, shifting the paradigm of only imagining male authority and male godliness, she said, was the thing we needed to change the world. Like the daughters of Zlofchad and Olympia, I also believe it's necessary to women to participate fully in society and to bake cakes for the Queen of Heaven to bring about the radical change in business as usual that we seek. A woman named Catherine Rhodes Henderson wrote a book called God's Troublemakers, How Women of Faith Are Changing the World. I mean, the title was enough for me. In it, there's hope for real change. Not women who take their place in society as it is, grateful to have a place at the table. And I have to say, when I went to rabbinical school some almost 40 years ago, there were women in my class. I was shocked. But there were women who just wanted a place at the table. They didn't want to change anything. They just wanted to be able to participate like their brothers, like their fathers, like their grandfathers had done. And it was hard for me. It was kind of like the blue hat, red hat thing. I did not like hearing that. I was critical. But I had to listen to them, and I understood. And then they humbled me. But it wasn't the way I saw it, still. I really saw us as she says, how we could bring women's values into patriarchal religion. And what she says is, mother an ailing society. I love that. Here are some categories, some things that she and I kind of took some of her ideas and kind of made them through my own lens. The first thing that I think we bring as women and men who are conscious of the goddess into this, into our world, is that the first value is the ethic of relationships. Radical hospitality, I heard it here this morning, everyone being welcome, finding a way to listen to each other, recognizing our differences, nurturing and understanding that our connections are interdependent. None of us can be free until all of us are free. The goddess teaches us that my freedom cannot be built on the backs of others, you know, and we have to recognize that in our how we buy things and, you know, how we participate in the society that we're in. The second, I went to Immokalee, Florida a couple of weeks ago to learn from the tomato pickers, you know, their story. The second is the ethic of inclusivity. This ethic values diversity and pluralism, especially including the marginalized and the most vulnerable. No one, the goddess, doesn't leave anybody out. This ethic accomplishes this by building coalitions and working collaboratively. The third is the belief in the possibility of transformation. Accepting the change of individuals and systems is not only possible, but it's necessary. And true change trusts grassroots processes that value the common good. The fourth is the ethic of business not as usual. We can make a difference in the world when we work outside of the structures of social society, when we make our health and the health of our planet the bottom line. I used to imagine that a pregnant president would never allow for toxins in food, you know, or near her, or near anyone else if they would threaten the health of their children, no matter what the cost was. Priorities would shift. The fifth is the ethic of seamlessness. This invites us to bridge worlds that are often kept separate. Bring your values to work, it says. The hope is to model the possibility of the integrity and integration between passion and practice, between the self and the institution. And finally, embracing a radical faith that calls us to alleviate suffering, oppression, and injustice, and calls us to resist evil and not merely avoid it. Some years ago, I discovered the goddess Kali. It was just right after September 11th, 2001, and like many people, I was really depressed and didn't know where to turn, and I happened to bump into Swami Chittanananda of the Vedanta Society. He said, "What's wrong with you, Susan?" I said, "Swami, you know, I just can't handle this anymore," and he's always, you know, making fun of me that I feel like. He says, "Susan, you are like the person who tries to uncurl the tail of the curly-tailed dog." He says, "The tail is curly, still curly, but Susan gets straightened out." That's what he always says to me. You know? But, you know, there's a balance, right? I still feel like we have to. He says, "You're always out there trying to fix things. Don't you know, that you have to just respond to suffering, but things are not going to change that much," he said. "But I will send you to my monastery," and he did. And I went to his monastery, Belarmath, outside of Calcutta. And across from the monastery, across the Ganges, is the main Kali temple in India. You know Kali? You don't want to mess with that goddess. She is a fierce mother goddess, but I got it. I got it. You know, every other place in India, I felt like there was hope, but not at the Kali Temple. The Kali Temple was the abyss. It was the black hole. It really was. It was the place where if you could stand that, you could stand anything, and there she was. This fierce mother goddess that would bite off the heads of the demons that would threaten her children and drink their blood, because when their blood hit the ground, it would grow more demons. And she was willing to do anything to save her children. I said, "That's my goddess." So I became really a devotee of Kali, and I have a little shrine to her in my office, Jewish rabbi and all. Because I think we need that fierce mother goddess, you know, today. So back to the Benot Zlofrad. Their strides for women seemed short-lived. In just a few verses after their revolution, we learn that a man's vow is taken seriously, but a woman's vow can be annulled by her father or her husband. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, in Olympia's day, said, this is a sign of, you remember in her Women's Bible? She said, this is a sign of the tutelage of women that we must overcome. But I think it's an important image. Because as I said, real change takes work, and it takes time, and it takes working in collaboration. The Benoit Zlofrad, Olympia Brown, and so many others dared to dream that one day we would live in a world that would once again acknowledge the equality and the holiness of all people, and that every one of us would be valued and be able to serve in holy ways. And we would once again bake cakes for the Queen of Heaven and pour libations in her honor. And everyone would have access to health care and a good education and safe and healthy food and water and rain in its time. And then we will see the promised land. For there will be, once again, joy in the towns of Judah, peace in the streets of Jerusalem, and we will figure out a way to live together in peace. And none of our children from Palestine and Israel to those villages in Africa to right here in the streets of St. Louis, none will be afraid. Thank you.
You have been listening to a sermon recorded at the First Unitarian Church of St. Louis.